This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Alan Shepard, was the first American in space. In 1961, he rode the space capsule Mercury 7 to an altitude of 115 miles. 10 years later, Shepard commanded the Apollo 14 on a mission to the moon. He set up a nuclear-powered science station on the moon and gathered soil and rock samples. In between those two space flights, Shepard was grounded for medical reasons, but he helped direct the space program as chief of NASA's astronaut office. He was an essential part of the team that helped America first get to the moon 25 years ago. Shepard has co-authored a new book about America's race to the moon called Moonshot. I asked him about his first space flight back in 1961. The trip was so brief, he didn't have much time to experiment with weightlessness.
My flight was only 16 minutes. We did have about 5.5 minutes of weightlessness. And the thing which we tried to cram into that 5.5 minutes had to do primarily with my ability to actually control the spacecraft, actually fly it like an airplane. Because we knew that so much of the early days of space depended upon the abilities of a pilot, not only under primary conditions with no casualties, no failures, but also to practice for situations where the pilot would have to take over in order to bring it back in safely. So most of the 5.5 minutes were devoted to my actually controlling the spacecraft and reporting how I was doing and that sort of thing.
How were you doing?
I did great, of course.
I mean, how did it feel to control the spacecraft while being weightless?
Well, it was a tremendous exhilaration, of course, at being up there in the first place. Also, the second place, the fact that everything was going well. And then, lastly, the fact that I flew it exactly as I was supposed to fly it.
Was it what you most wanted, to be that first American in space?
Oh, I think all of us wanted that. We were a very highly competitive group to start with. We were all test pilots. We knew that only one of the seven was going to get to go first. And, you know, everybody wanted to go.
Now, after you became the first American in space, you got something called Meniere's syndrome. Am I pronouncing that correctly?
Yes, that's correct. Actually, I had been assigned to command the first Gemini mission, which was the first two-man mission, and Tom Stafford was going to be my co-pilot. We were probably 3 or 4 months into a training cycle when I developed Meniere syndrome, which has something to do with elevated fluid pressure in the inner ear, which causes dizziness, imbalance, nausea in some cases. And when we discovered it was more than just a temporary virus, then NASA, of course, grounded me immediately and said, you can stick around if you want. There is maybe 20% chance that you might recover from this thing normally. And if you want to stick around and stay in training, we'll be happy to have you do that. We'll give you a job helping Slayton run the astronaut training program.
It must have been devastating for you.
Very disappointing. Not only the initial reaction to it, to the onset of it, the realization that I wasn't going to fly again right away, and then continuing to watch the rest of the guys go down to the Cape and have all these great flights and pat them on the head before they went, and you know, and pat them on the fanny when they came back. It wasn't all that much fun. There was a lot of frustration involved.
You were the chief of the astronaut office, which meant that you, among other things, had to choose which men went on the flights. What would you look for in an astronaut's personality and temperament before deciding to schedule them for a flight?
Well, what we did for the most part was to choose the ones who, the individuals who we thought would make the best commander of the flight, and then ask them which of the available astronauts they would like to fly with. So get an idea that we got two folks, or three folks in the case of Apollo, at least friendly with each other. We made a couple of mistakes, but for the most part, things went along pretty well.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Alan Shepard, and he's written a new book called Moonshot, The Inside Story of America's Race to the Moon. During a launch pad test of Apollo 1, There was a fire and three astronauts were killed, Gus Grissom, Edward White, and Roger Chaffee. What happened?
Well, I think, let me generalize first, and I think what the situation was at that time was that we had flown successful Mercury missions, we had flown successful Gemini missions. There was a sense of pride and accomplishment, but there was also perhaps a little false sense of security, maybe a little bit too much pride, maybe a little bit overconfidence, if you will, and desire, obviously, to get on with the moon landing to try to meet President Kennedy's schedule. And we talk about this in the book, in pointing out the fact that Grissom, who was designated to be the commander of that flight, was not at all pleased with some of the things he found in the manufacturing and the testing processes. And even though he protested rather strenuously, somehow the things that needed to be fixed didn't get fixed in time. And, of course, it is a tragedy, in fact, that Gus was killed in the fire along with Ed White and Roger Chaffee. But on the other hand, at this stage in the game, although obviously it's traumatic to lose your buddies, all of a sudden the NASA people and the aerospace contractor people said, hey, you know, this thing really wasn't put together as well as it could have been. Maybe we were in too much of a hurry. There was some redesign. There was a hiatus trying to find out exactly what had happened. And with this redesign, with this reassessment, we created a spacecraft that was obviously so much better than the Apollo 1 spacecraft had been. Again, it was really as a result of that fire that all of a sudden the organization said, yeah, folks, we really aren't doing as well as we could have been. And again, that resulted in a really fine program all in all.
You write in your book that you felt you couldn't get too emotional about it and that you had to take the attitude, well, it's part of the business. Did you have to take that attitude for the benefit of the other men who were waiting to be launched?
I think that all of us in those days, basically being test pilots, felt that that was the way things go in our business. I mean, it wasn't the first of our friends that had been killed. A lot of contemporaries over the years of test flying had been lost, killed for one reason or another. So it wasn't the first time that it happened within our fraternity of test pilots. And as I say, it was emotional, but it's one of those things, well, you've got to find out what happened, correct it, and let's get on with the job, folks.
Alan Shepard is my guest, and he writes about being the first man in space and his walk on the moon and many other things as well in a new book that he co-authored called Moonshot. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Alan Shepard, co-author of the new book Moonshot. You were grounded for several years because of an inner ear problem, and then you were able to be cured through a surgical process that surprised everybody by working and working very well. So then you got to go to the moon, which you'd long wanted to do. But when you took that flight, the Apollo 14, in 1971, February of 1971, you felt that you carried the whole future of the space program with you. Why did your mission have such symbolic import?
Well, that's kind of an interesting story. Actually, as soon as I was ungrounded and NASA said, okay, we think you're ready to go, Slayton and I immediately picked a crew and gave me command of Apollo 13. We sent the list to Washington. They said, oh, we can't do that. We said, now, wait a minute, you know, Shepard has been training along with everybody. He's just as bright and just as ready to go as the rest of them. How come? They said, well, it's just too soon. You give us a political problem. Shepard is so well known, and he's been obviously grounded for so many years, and politically it's just not right. So let's make a deal. Give us another crew for Apollo 13, and we'll let Shepard have 14. So, as you may recall, Apollo 13 took off with Jim Lovell and Fred Hayes and Jack Swigert. They're halfway on the way to the moon, and they had an explosion which blew out the side of the service module, the mothership. It took away all their primary power system, and there they were on the way to the moon without the power to do it. Obviously, they weren't going to be able to land. They used the lunar module power systems to communicate, to help navigate, and with the help of the people on the ground, of course, it did a fantastic job and came back safely. But then the next flight all of a sudden is under the gun. It said, well, yeah, we made a couple of landings, but we had an explosion. Do we really need to keep doing this? Don't we have enough rocks the way it is? So there was starting to be criticism of the program as a result of the explosion. Then there was the fact that the two chaps I had chosen to go with me had not flown before, and my buddies didn't give me a heck of a lot of credit for just 16 minutes of spaceflight, so we were dubbed the Three Rookies, Apollo 14, the Three Rookies, and that put a little bit of added interest. It gave us a little bit of additional incentive to absolutely fly the very best flight that had ever been flown before or since. And quite frankly, we came very close to that.
How old were you for this flight?
Well, actually, when I was walking around the moon, I was 47 years old.
That's pretty old for an astronaut. That's pretty old for a flight to the moon, isn't it?
Well, I think age is a very much of an individual thing. I still feel very young at my current age, which is, you know.
Now, before you landed on the moon, you lost your radar, and Mission Control was thinking you should abort, but you didn't. Why didn't you want to abort?
You got to be kidding. I mean, after going 230,000 miles, you're going to worry about a little radar? Come on.
A little radar? I mean, what was it like for you to maneuver the ship without radar? What was blinded without radar?
Well, actually, let me just back up a little bit. We had a problem earlier on the way out where we couldn't dock with a lunar module. That was traumatic. We finally got that resolved, and off we went with permission to land. We started down. Well, we didn't actually start down, but we ran the computer down open loop, and it refused to go down because there was a bad switch. And so that was point number two. Either one of those would have ruined the mission. So we were pretty objectively oriented when we came to the point where, during the descent, one is not looking at the moon. You're looking away from the surface. And in order to be allowed to continue below around 13,000 feet or so, one has to have an update from landing radar. We were down around 20,000, somewhere along in there, and we were not getting updated on the radar. And we were being told from the ground that the radar wasn't working. We said, thank you very much. We understand the radar is not working. We can tell that. And they reminded us that we didn't have landing radar in by 13,000 feet. We said, yeah, we remember all that stuff. And it was getting pretty tense and pretty close. Finally, some bright young guy in the control center said, hey, this landing radar is working, but it's locked on infinity. Have them recycle, pull a circuit breaker and see what happens. So we pulled the circuit breaker, and sure enough, the landing radar came in with a matter of, maybe a half a minute or so to spare. We go on down and land, and we're shutting off the switches, and my co-pilot, Ed Mitchell, said to me, Alan, what were you going to do if the landing radar was not in at 13,000 feet? And I said, Ed, you will never know.
Well, what did you plan on doing?
I think I would have gone down, at least to the point where we could have pitched over and taken a look at the surface, because had great great faith in our ability to land from almost any off-nominal case. We practiced that in the simulator for hours and hours and hours. And so I had a feeling that if I could just see it and realize I wasn't running into any mountains or anything, that I probably would have gone down.
What surprised you most about how the surface of the moon looked?
I don't think we had any surprises about the actual surface of the moon, about the barrenness. We had looked at pictures of our landing site taken by previous missions. We had worked with the models that were made from those pictures. We knew the general configuration of where the craters were supposed to be. We knew the objective of Cone Crater, which was the one we climbed up the side of to get rock samples. There weren't any surprises there. The surprise I had was standing on the surface after we'd been there for a few minutes, having a chance to rest a little bit and looking up at the Earth for the first time. Now, you have to look up because that's where it is. And the sky is totally black, and here you have a planet which is four times the size of the moon as we look at it from the Earth. And then you also have a color. You have a blue oceans and the brown land masses, the brown continents, and you can see ice on the ice caps on the North Pole and so on. And just an absolute incredible view. And then you say, that looks a little small to me. It looks like it does have limits. It's a little fragile. You know, down here we think it's infinite. We don't worry about resources. Up there you're saying, gosh, you know, it's a shame those folks down there can't get along together and think about trying to conserve, to save what limited resources they have. And it was just very, very emotional. I actually shed a couple of tears looking up at the Earth and having those feelings.
What was the best advice that you got from astronauts who'd been to the moon before?
Probably, it ain't so tough after all, fellas. Just go up there and relax and have fun.
One of the things you did on the moon was to hit a couple of golf balls. Where did the golf club come from and the golf balls? And why'd you do it?
Well, I enjoyed the game of golf before I went, and I tried to think of something that would demonstrate the fact we only had 1/6 gravity, which means the ball is going to go six times as far for the same club head speed. There's no atmosphere, so the ball is not going to hook or slice. And the time of flight is going to be six times as long. So I started thinking about it and very quickly realized that we had a collapsible handle there, aluminum handle, we used with a scoop on the end. And we used that to scoop up samples of dust, and we put them in a little bag and mark the bag and bring it back. We use that because it's very difficult to bend over and get a sample from a virgin dust. But that would have been left up there, so I took a look at it, and it was about the same as the length of a shaft of a number 6 iron. So I got the head of a number 6 and cut it off and put a little fitting, had a pro put a little fitting on it to snap on the end of this club. And I had the club head and the two golf balls in the pocket of my suit. I had practiced before we went. I got the boss's permission to do it. And at the very end of the mission, when all was completed, I snapped the club head on the handle, tossed the two golf balls down in the dust, kind of teed them up a little bit, and took a whack and did it in front of the television camera. So we have a great picture in the book of this ball sailing up and off into the black sky. The suit was kind of cumbersome, and I couldn't swing as hard as I wanted, so it probably would have gone maybe 30, 35 yards with one hand shot here on the Earth, but it went over 200 yards. The time of flight was like 40 seconds. Just absolute thrill for me to do that. And in the book, you actually see the picture of the golf ball still in the frame, which is kind of cute.
And one of the things that really amazes me about your life is that, okay, you're the first man in space, American in space, and then you walk on the moon. But when you were young, you went to school in a one-room schoolhouse. It seems like such an enormous gap between a one-room schoolhouse and a walk on the moon.
Well, that's true. But I sense that there is something here that was helpful to me. I remember, of course, that being in a one-room school with one teacher, there was a tremendous amount of learning learning time there. Very, very strict teacher, as I recall. She was about 8 feet tall, and she had a long yardstick that she used to whack our knuckles with. But there was a sense of discipline instilled at that time, which I responded favorably to. And I think that sense of discipline obviously served me in good stead going through the Naval Academy, served me in good stead as a pilot, as a test pilot, as an astronaut. So maybe, maybe that one-room school thing wasn't so bad after all.
Were there airports around you when you were growing up?
There was one fairly close by. In high school, I used to work at that airport on weekends. I'd ride my bike up and push airplanes in and out of the hangars and get a free ride once in a while.
Did you love it?
Oh, yeah. I've always wanted to fly. Built model airplanes. Lindbergh was my hero when he flew across the Atlantic. And very, very fortunately, we're talking about Apollo 11. When the Apollo 11 launched, I was at the Cape, standing by myself over in a VIP observation section, a figure in a pair of fatigues and an old sailor hat turned upside down came over and reintroduced himself as Colonel Charles Lindbergh. I had met him before, but only briefly. But that moment, the two of us stood there and nobody bothered us. We were there for 15 or 20 minutes without interruption. And I was telling him at that time, as my hero, how much he had meant to me and how much he encouraged me indirectly to become involved in aviation. And he said very, very graciously, "Well, obviously, Captain, at that time," he said, "you're doing the same thing for the people who are going to fly in space tomorrow to the planets and beyond." And it was a very poignant moment, one which I will never forget.
Well, Alan Shepard, thank you so much for talking with us.
My pleasure, Terry.
Alan Shepard is the co-author of the new book Moonshot, the inside story of America's race to the moon. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.